Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 572, titled The Liberty Incident. This is being recorded on October 8th of the year 2006. Before we get into the subject of this broadcast, which is the attack on the USS Liberty, a U.S. intelligence gathering ship, that attack was performed by Israeli aircraft and torpedo boats during the 1967 war. A couple of introductory remarks to this broadcast that are also a posit to For the Record 571, Your Mama Works for the Mossad. During the recording of For the Record 571, there was a glitch, and I wound up getting a cue from my engineer that we had 5 minutes less than we actually did, so I wound up doing some impromptu hurrying on the program. There is quite a bit more information. There were a number of other topics of discussion that I had wanted to include. I'm going to put those in the description for the broadcast, because it just isn't enough material for a full program this time around. One of the things that I wanted to speak about were the Suk Ching massacres in Asia during World War II. The Chinese are often called the Jews of Asia, and in Malaysia, in Indonesia, and in parts of the Philippines, the Chinese minority, who are very highly educated and very prosperous, are often persecuted by the Muslim majorities. And when the Japanese occupied those areas in World War II, they actively persecuted the Chinese minorities as a way of, in fact, did more than persecute, they slaughtered them to a large extent, as a way of currying favor with the Muslim majorities in those countries. The Grand Mufti, Haji Amin al-Husseini, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, and as I noted, not only an SS major, but a man whose entire professional life has been associated with genocide, from his beginnings as a Turkish army officer in World War I, the same Turkish army that was exterminating Armenians, and that was also engaging in a brutal counterinsurgency campaign against Arab forces fighting for the British. Haji Amin al-Husseini actually did work for the Japanese, broadcasting in support of the Suk Ching massacres. But that probably should be the focal point of another broadcast somewhere down the line. But for those people, and I would assume they're probably a fairly large number, who are not altogether satisfied with the latter part of For the Record 571, again, there was a glitch in recording, and there was other information that I wanted to include in that. We just didn't have time, but there's not enough for a second broadcast. So please do get into the habit of using the long written descriptions on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com in the For the Record section. With regard to the broadcasts, Middle East Matrix, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, those descriptions are essential because there's photographic information in those descriptions that obviously I couldn't include in the broadcast itself due to the fact that this is radio. Sort of by way of capping the programming that I've done over the last couple of months in the wake of the Lebanon War in connection with the Israeli-Arab conflict and related topics, I thought that it might be useful to go into the Liberty incident of 1967. That is an incident that has been systematically misrepresented by all sides, and that the U.S. has misrepresented it, the military has misrepresented it, the Israelis have misrepresented it, and people who are of anti-Semitic and or fascist persuasion have often used that in a distorted fashion as well. I recently heard a tape of a broadcast made on the Pacifica Radio Network in which the host of the program, who shall remain nameless, this is one of the stars of Pacifica, had on none other than Admiral Thomas Moore, a retired U.S. Navy admiral, and he was talking about the Liberty incident, and the thrust of the discussion was that this was an incident intended to provoke the U.S. into attacking the Arabs. Well, in fact, there was no attempt at making the Israeli aircraft or torpedo boats look Egyptian. They could have changed insignia, and the sinking of the Liberty would have been quite easy to do. I would note in that context that Admiral Thomas Moore is a member of the Board of Directors of Western Goals, a domestic, actually an international private think tank of fascist persuasion that was engaged in, among other things, an illegal spying scandal in the early 1980s in which members of the LAPD's special spying unit were engaged in political espionage on behalf of Western goals, and they were taking the information from that espionage operation and sending it not only to their own computer banks, that is to say Western goals computer banks, but computer banks in Germany. It's quite ironic that Admiral Moore would be holding forth on the Pacifica Network. He's deceased now, because I'll guarantee you there were people in the Pacifica LA station who were spied upon in that scandal. In any event, however, we're going to talk about the USS Liberty incident, and we're going to be accessing information from the book The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, book published in hard and soft cover by the St. Martin's Press, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Now, the USS Liberty was not only a spy ship, but specifically was working for the National Security Agency, and what it was engaged in was relaying signals intelligence about Israel to the Arabs. Now, as we've spoken about in a number of past broadcasts, particularly some of our interviews with John Loftus and some of the treatments of this important book, although the U.S. Is officially allied with Israel, in point of fact, due to the fact that Israel doesn't have oil and the Arabs do, and with oil being the centerpiece of the industrial economy and also arguably the greatest source of wealth and consequently power in the industrialized world, behind the scenes, the American power elite has always been more pro-Arab than pro-Israeli. Officially pro-Israeli, but behind the scenes, pro-Arab due to the economic interests. The USS Liberty was not attacked by accident. The Israelis knew full well what they were doing. What they were doing was neutralizing its signals intelligence capability because there had been a behind-the-scenes agreement between elements of U.S. and British intelligence and the Arabs to provide them with military intelligence about Israel in order to further their efforts in the Six-Day War of 1967. That is the argument in a nutshell. We're going to read about that from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Speaking of the Six-Day War, they write, "For the first time in 2,000 years, Jews around the world swelled their chests with pride. When an American ship, the USS Liberty, was accidentally damaged in the conflict, President Johnson graciously accepted the immediate apology of the government of Israel. Despite some American casualties, the United States and Israel remained firm friends. Our sources say that there is much more to the story than that, much more. The U.S. and British governments, while pretending to be on Israel's side, were giving all of Israel's secrets to the Arabs. In many ways, it was the Western spies who indirectly started the war. In this chapter, we examine the following allegations. 1. Western intelligence informed the Arabs that Israel would not have a nuclear defense shield finished in 1967, thus leaving a window of opportunity for attack. 2. Realizing the danger of a massed Arab attack, the Israelis informed the United States of their intention to launch a preemptive strike, which the CIA promptly betrayed to the Arabs. 3. U.S. intelligence attempted to curry favor with the Arab oil producers by giving the precise details of Israel's order of battle to the Arabs during the war. 4. Israeli intelligence discovered the American betrayal and attacked the U.S. ship, the Liberty, which was gathering electronic information on Israeli troop movements and sending it to British intelligence, which in turn relayed it to the Arabs. Both the American and Israeli governments agreed to suppress the truth about the Liberty incident from the public. Israel mourned the loss of President Kennedy deeply. Before he died, Kennedy had blunted Nasser's missile threat, made the first arms shipments from the U.S. government, and backed Israel repeatedly in the United Nations. The Israelis did not know what to make of his successor, Lyndon Baines Johnson. In public, Johnson had been an ardent supporter of Israel. In private, however, they feared that he was and would always remain an oil man. In fact, the Israelis did not trust Johnson at all. After the Suez debacle, they would never trust any American with the lives of their citizens. They launched a crash program to complete their first atomic warhead. During the early 1960s, the Kennedy administration watched the construction of the Israeli nuclear reactor at Dimona with some concern and increase the number of American spies in Israel. Kennedy offered Israel a deal. If it would stop its nuclear project, the United States would provide $600 million for a nuclear-powered water desalination plant. The Israelis refused. They knew that sooner or later one of the Arab states would start manufacturing poison gas and germ warfare weapons. The threat of a nuclear weapon would be the only thing that could deter the Arabs from starting another Holocaust. After Kennedy died, Johnson watched the reactor at Dimona go into full production with French assistance. The Jews had atomic energy, but they did not yet have an atomic bomb. Although Seymour Hersh's excellent book covers this subject in some detail, there are a few key details he missed. Parenthetically, that book is The Samson Option. Continuing. As will be seen in the next chapter, the Israelis had used their window inside West German intelligence during the 1960s to obtain Argentine uranium and South African testing facilities. The Israelis were using both the German and the French A-bomb programs to further their own purposes. What Hersh also did not know is that the CIA had several agents working in Israel under various cover assignments. One of them confirmed to us that in the spring of 1967, the Israelis had the potential to make a nuclear warhead, but had not succeeded yet. They were at least a year away from making a working prototype. During that time, the Jews still would be vulnerable to surprise attack. Somehow, this information found its way from the CIA to the Arabs. Some of our sources among the old spies say that it was Miles Copeland's handwork. Others say it was the long arm of British intelligence aided by NSA technology. As we shall see, the NSA routinely shared Israel's secrets with the British, who just as frequently passed them on to the Arabs. Whoever was responsible, the leak of the Israeli atomic schedule set off a race against time. The Arabs had one last period of opportunity to smash the Jewish state with conventional weapons. The Israelis had less than a year to try to finish one weapon before the United Arab Armies launched their attack. In fact, it would take Israeli scientists much longer than they had estimated to get the A-bomb. The American intelligence reports that Israel could not prepare a nuclear defense shield in 1967 gave the Arabs some breathing room to plan their next battle against the Jews. In the spring of that year, Nasser was temporarily occupied fighting a war in Yemen where he was testing chemical and biological weapons in preparation for his final solution of the Jewish problem. According to Nasser's original timetable, he would launch the final attack on Israel in late 1967. The cooler fall weather would greatly facilitate an armored invasion. The Egyptian Soviet-built tanks had no air conditioning and were ovens in the summer. A fall attack also would give him the time to pull his 50,000 men and their heavy armor out of Yemen and move them into the Sinai. Israel would be crushed long before its first warhead was completed. As the summer of 1967 approached, it was clear that war was coming again to the Middle East. The tiny nation of Israel was not even 20 years old, but appeared headed for extinction by its powerful neighbors, which surrounded it on nearly all fronts. President Gamal Abdel Nasser, the radical nationalist who ruled Egypt, had begun with a massive radio propaganda campaign calling on the Arab nations to unite in the destruction of the Jews. The powerful Egyptian army, massively equipped by the Soviet Union, had begun its slow, ponderous movement over the Sinai Desert toward Israel. Israeli intelligence suspected that Syria and Jordan were preparing to launch simultaneous sneak attacks from the north and east as soon as the Egyptians had everything in place in the south. Egyptian artillery moved to close the Red Sea to any vessel flying the Israeli flag and blockaded the Israeli port of Eilat. This was a clear violation of international law, but the UN did nothing except accede to Nasser's request and order its emergency force out of harm's way in preparation for the assault. The Americans agreed that Egyptian interference with Israeli shipping on international waters was an official act of war. Even Nasser had acknowledged as much back in 1956 as a condition for Israel's withdrawal after the Suez Campaign. In 1967, the United States offered its sympathy but refused to provide any military assistance whatsoever. President Johnson turned his back. The Israelis told their American ally that if it would not help, it should keep its planes and ships away from the combat area and Israel would fight by itself. one of the most widely reported but least understood battles in the secret war against the Jews was about to begin. One of the few espionage battles in the war to be fought entirely at sea. By early June 1967, the Israelis knew that Nasser's invasion could come at any time. On June 5th, Israel launched a preemptive attack before the Egyptian army could finish its buildup and reach its borders. The first 3 days of tank battles saw the tiny Israeli army pushing the Egyptians back across the Sinai, away from Israel, and the destruction of the Arab air forces. It was a heroic achievement that was marred by one unfortunate mistake, or so the Israeli government says. The unfortunate mistake, unquote, was the attack on the USS Liberty stationed off the Sinai coast. As we're about to see, this was no mistake at all. And indeed, knowing a little bit about military affairs and having gone over the Liberty incident, among the things that indicates that something very different was happening here was the actual nature of the attack. There was first a strafing attack, then, and I'll toss the gauntlet down to anyone out there, cite me another incidence of a napalm attack on a ship, then finally torpedo boats fired a single torpedo into the Liberty. It would have been the simplest of things for a single aircraft to have sunk the Liberty. Sinking it was not the motive. And one of the keys, I think, to the accuracy of the account here is the napalm attack, because napalm was dropped on the Liberty to destroy some of the very sensitive aluminum antennae that were on this ship for the purposes of relaying electronic intelligence. Again, as far as I've been able to determine, this is the only time that napalm was ever used in an attack on a ship at sea, because indeed napalm is for use against bunkered land forces. We're going to first go into the agreement that led ultimately to the Liberty incident. The Israelis had broken the Arab ciphers and codes, enabling them to feed false messages to the enemy. The phony messages led the Jordanians to believe that the war was going well for Nasser when, in fact, the Egyptians already had been effectively knocked out of the battle. Such signals deception was bound to make King Hussein think about joining in on the victorious side. It was then, Richard Deacon, a British espionage writer, asserts, that things started to go badly wrong for the Israelis. And then quoting from Deacon's book about the Liberty incident, on the night of June 7th, the Mossad knew that their deception plan had been spotted by the Americans. The Israeli ambassador was called to the State Department and told that the Israeli attack must be halted forthwith, as a ceasefire was to be ordered by the United Nations. When the ambassador protested, he was informed in diplomatic language that the United States knew that Jordan had been lured into fighting by signal deception. It was obvious that, if Liberty continued with her transmissions, it could be disastrous for Israel, as they would be able to reveal that the Israelis were in violation of a UN ceasefire order. According to Deacon, the Israelis ordered that the ship, which was a threat to the Jews' plans, must be put out of action, whatever flag it was flying, unquote. The Israelis feared, quote, there could be leakages from the State Department to the United Nations, and even worse, the latter, whose administrators were already biased against Israel, could pass on information to the Egyptians, unquote. The Israelis were not stupid. They knew that the State Department's Middle Eastern policies had a pronounced anti-Semitic tilt. By the way, that is still, in fact, the case, although there are people within the Bush administration who are pro-Israeli. One of the things that generally gets almost no discussion is the fact that the top State Department official with regard to Middle Eastern policy, occupying a post that was specifically created for her, is none other than Elizabeth Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter. And she basically is controlling U.S. Middle Eastern policy. And Dick Cheney, by the way, a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas, rather like George Walker Bush. Continuing. Further, it was not idle speculation that Israel's secrets might end up in Egyptian hands. According to our sources in the American intelligence community who talked to us about the Liberty incident, passing Israeli secrets to the Egyptians was the whole idea of stationing the ship off the Sinai coast in the first place. They believed that all the published versions of the Liberty incident, the crews, the Israelis, the U.S. governments, Wilbur Crane Evelyn's, and Deacon's are wrong. By the way, Wilbur Crane Evelyn is a former U.S. intelligence operative who wrote a book, Ropes of Sand. Continuing. When the authors described what we already knew from Western sources, several Israelis reluctantly provided corroboration of the best-kept secret of the Six-Day War. Contrary to the Israeli government's categorical denials, the assault on the Liberty had been deliberate, but it was an act of self-defense. The old spies, unquote, are adamant that the Liberty crew only knows the what and not the why of what happened. Similarly, although Eveland and Deacon exposed the fact that the Israelis knew what they were doing when they attacked the ship, they did not know the real reason. Even U.S. naval intelligence did not piece together what had happened until years later, and they had to get the most of the answers from the British, who got them from the NSA. This is the real version of the Liberty incident, as told by our sources among the former intelligence officers who were there on both sides of the battle, i.e. U.S. and Israeli and some British. Continuing. In the weeks preceding the 1967 war, the Israeli embassy in Washington fully briefed the CIA and the White House on its strategy to preempt the Arab invasion. Once before, the Israelis had launched a preemptive strike in the Sinai without Washington's explicit approval. The 1956 Suez debacle still rankled in everyone's memory. This time, the Israelis wanted to make sure that they had not crossed wires with their most important, perhaps only, ally in the world. Every major facet of the impending campaign was discussed in advance, including the strike against Syria. Our sources insist that the U.S. government knew that the Israelis were going to attack the Golan Heights weeks before it happened and gave them the green light. Syria was in the Soviet camp and no particular friend of the United States. Jordan was another matter. According to the old spies, parenthetically, that's a group of former U.S., British, Israeli, and Russian intelligence operatives who spoke to Loftus and Ahrens on condition of anonymity, beginning again. According to the old spies we interviewed on this point, a CIA agent in Amman, Jordan, leaked word to Jordan's King Hussein about the secret Israeli briefing. Everyone likes to tell good news. The Israelis would counterattack only in the north and south against Egypt and Syria. Under American pressure, the Israelis had agreed not to send troops into the West Bank. As long as Jordan did not attack Israel from the east, King Hussein could stay out of the water and keep the provinces of Judea, Samaria, and the old city of Jerusalem, which the Jordanian army had stolen from Palestine back in 1948. It was a good deal for Jordan, but not good enough. King Hussein was under pressure from the Arab world to join in the attack against Israel. It would be a little embarrassing for him to sit back and do nothing while the Egyptian and Syrian armies came hundreds of miles to fight the Jews. From one point in Jordanian territory in the West Bank, it was less than a 10-mile drive across Israel to the ocean. A Jordanian armored column could cut the country in half. The king had to do something to appease his Arab brothers, so he sent Jordanian troops to attack from Syria, while promising the CIA that not a single Jordanian soldier would attack Israel from the West Bank. Hussein slyly omitted his plan to place Jordanian troops under Nasser's control as well. The CIA passed the word on to Israel not to worry about an attack on its highly vulnerable eastern flank. Through one of their spies, the Israelis quickly found out about the CIA deal with King Hussein, and they were furious. It may not have made a lot of difference to the CIA if Jordanian troops were fighting on the northern front, but it made a lot of difference to the Jews. But this was nothing compared to what the Jews found out next. When the Israelis discovered that the Americans also had made a deal with the Egyptians, they became even more furious at the CIA. To be fair, our sources in the intelligence community acknowledge that, by and large, the CIA was just a messenger boy. The real decisions were being made in the White House. Aramco and the other big players in the oil business were extremely concerned that American aid to Israel would alienate the Arab oil producers. It was not enough to withhold military assistance in the coming war. Everyone in the Muslim world knew that the United States was still neutral in favor of Israel. The oil men wanted some under-the-table help for the Arabs. President Lyndon Johnson had been in the oil business himself down in Texas and knew how the game was played. The oil producers got to LBJ or someone very close to him in the White House. Our sources were never able to find out who. The oil men asked if the president could throw the Arabs a bone, some sort of secret assistance that the public would never find out about, but would make the Arab leadership grateful. The point was to keep the oil flowing no matter what happened in the 1967 war. The White House approved a contingency plan to send the Arabs a little intelligence about the Israeli Defense Forces, not too much, nothing that would tip the balance of war. Just a little something to let the Arab leaders think that the Americans were secretly on their side no matter what was said about Israel in public. Unfortunately, the small-scale contingency plan escalated. No one planned it that way. Only a handful of staffers in the White House, the National Security Agency, and the CIA knew what had happened, and they all pointed the finger at each other. We're going to be continuing with this account on side two of the broadcast. Again, the Israeli account and the U.S. account are BS, and both sides know that. That attack was no accident. The Israelis knew full well what they were doing, and the account here is by far and away the most credible. One of the indicative things, as I said, was the actual nature of the attack. If Israel had wanted to sink the Liberty, that would have been the simplest of things to do. They made no attempt at disguising the insignia on their aircraft or their torpedo boats, and there has never, as far as I've been able to determine, have been another use of napalm on a seaborne ship or any ship that I have been able to find out about, and military affairs are something I know a fair amount about. We're going to talk about this in Side 2. Again, I've cited the vast wealth of information that's available on the Spitfire website, long article-length descriptions of the programs, as in the case of 571, often containing information that I simply did not have the time to include in the original broadcast. So if you're only listening to the programs, then you're missing out on a nice chunk of what we're doing. By the way, I don't know if we're going to have time to get to it on Side 2. That will depend. But interestingly, the U.S. ambassador to Israel at this time was a right-wing oil-connected Democrat who was an LBJ appointee. That guy was a guy named Wally Barber, who was the father of Haley Barber, the Republican governor of Mississippi, whose New Bridge Strategies company is one of the major contractors in Iraq and also has some cross contracts with firms connected to the Al-Taqwa complex. So, interestingly, there's a intergenerational heritage here that's quite interesting, because it was Haley Barber's father, Wally Barber, who, again, a right-wing oil Democrat, who was the U.S. ambassador to Israel throughout this entire incident. But again, avail yourselves of the Spitfire websites, the long article-length descriptions. Avail yourselves of the two websites maintained by the heroic sister station WFMU, which is archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio and also MP3. They're also podcasting For the Record. So if you want For the Record to be cast into your pod, so to speak, contact FMU. There's also a mini library, literally, of old, out-of-print anti-fascist books available for download for free. There's a search function on the website. There are links to various other websites, a blog spot, a website featuring the declassified U.S. government documents about the Bush family's connections with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. And last but certainly not least, that most underused web page as a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 572, The Liberty Incident, being recorded on October 8th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.